Welcome to the latest episode in our podcast series, Continued Conversations of the International Academy for Leadership of the Friedrich Naumann Foundation in Germany. In today's episode, we would like to talk about these Gen Z uprisings. We hear more and more in many countries that this is the case, and we would like to understand these youth protests from a liberal lens. From Colombo all the way to Casablanca, youth-led uprisings have rewritten the political landscape and have challenged entrenched governance systems. We saw that in Sri Lanka, 2022, there was this Aragalaya movement that emerged amid severe economic turmoil, marked by surging inflation, acute shortages of fuel and medicine, and youth activists set up protest camps in front of Colombo's presidential secretariat and led to some significant political shifts. In Morocco, there's the Gen Z 212 movement that mobilized hundreds of thousands in 2025 to demand improvements to public education and healthcare, criticizing government spending on the 2030 FIFA Football World Cup infrastructure, and also had significant impact on the policy discussions in Morocco. And I'm not here alone. I'm glad to say that I'm joined by Arpita Nepal, my co-facilitator, co-moderator today.
Thank you, Rainer. And it so happens that Rainer and I happen to live in two countries that have also gone through Gen Z movements. So Rainer was based in Indonesia when the Gen Z movement was happening, and I am based in Nepal. And to discuss more specifically about the context and the situation, what brought it about, we are joined by two excellent guests who were part, who are also based in these countries that went through Gen Z movements, and we want to understand that better. So joining us from Morocco is Katia. And Katia, I'd like you to take over and introduce yourself.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to speak to your podcast. My name is Katia, and I'm actually working as a senior program manager at the Arab Center for Research, which is one of its kind, a classical liberal think tank in Morocco. And it was the first classical liberal think tank across the Arab world. So what we do is the conventional as well as some of non-conventional parts of the work of a think tank. We write long papers, book chapters, organize conferences and workshop. Though we are based in Morocco, our work is more of has a regional scope. So we're working with countries across the MENA region on issues related to economic development and also democratic processes in the countries of the region.
That's very fascinating, because I think a lot of the movements focused around accountability and governance systems. And so that would be very interesting perspective to hear from Katia. We're also joined today by Thananath from Sri Lanka. Thananath, if you could introduce yourself.
Thank you, Arpita. Thank you, Reina. And hi, Katia. I'm Thananath. I'm joining from Sri Lanka. I work as a CEO for Advocata Institute, which is a research institute more on the market side of the spectrum, and I'm one of the founding members, and glad and honored to join IF podcast.
Dana, maybe you could also share a little bit about the nature of the work of Advocata. So what kind of areas you're covering?
Yeah, in terms of our areas of work, we mainly do research on state-owned enterprises and trade, because in terms of Sri Lanka's context, those are the two key areas that we thought are critical for Sri Lanka's development. And I would like to connect it later on the Aragalaya, the uprising and the impact of it.
Thank you. Wonderful. So in this episode, I want to start off talking about the timing of these protests. What sparked these movements at that particular moment when they happened? Sri Lanka has been going through economic challenges for a while, but then in 2022, it escalated. And in Morocco, there were these maternal deaths that sparked the anger in 2025. So is this timing revealing a level of frustration that has grown over years, or does it take that spark? Could it be any time? But the spark is more important. So Does that relate to the pandemic that we had and the isolation that the youth experienced beforehand? So I'm just curious about the timing at the beginning. Maybe I can ask Katia to start us off with talking about the specific timing of the protests in 2025.
Yeah, so like all other protest movements, if you look and dig behind the root causes, they're very multifaceted. So, of course, you have a young generation that is so well connected internationally and also able to see what was happening in Nepal and Madagascar. And so there is that part of belonging to a community. The young generation and the Gen Zs, as you may know, spend more time on social media network than they would spend with their own parents or friends. So there is that part of them being so well internationally connected. But of course, there are the different economics and social realities also in a country, that the deaths of the women, which was very unfortunate in a hospital in Agadir, not only spark the movement, but echo something that is much deeper that we have been complaining about in Morocco, the healthcare system and educational system. So that was the momentum with this debt, which was so unfortunate and shook the opinion. But also something that is interesting is that if you would ask people a couple of months ago before the Gen Z protest movement about this young generation, they would tell you that they don't have any interest or say on economics or social changes or what have you. They are so much into their TikToks recording and playing video. So it's also somehow, though we know that there were really deeply entrenched root causes for that kind of movement and mobilization. But the fact that we had that maybe wrong perception now that we can see with the benefit of the hindsight, that yes, they still are very much interested and following what's happening at a social and economic level. And of course, the pandemic, those are people who during the COVID were like between 16 and 18 and years old. And it has been very, I would say, like something that constitutes a part of their personality. And during this time where there was a lot of isolation, it even feds on their desire to be connected and to replace that kind of true human connection by being extremely connected, which of course helped not only in being inspired by what's happening in other countries, but also in connecting with other youth throughout Morocco and on organizing different groups through Discord. That was the platform used in Morocco, for instance. So it's very multifaceted. It's the social and economic background, but it's also the connectivity, the what is happening internationally. It's very multifaceted, right? Indeed.
Right. Can you say a bit more about that spark? These women, these unfortunate women, what happened? I mean, and was it so specifically shocking that goes beyond the normal in Morocco? Was that something very special that happened to them?
It's, yes, I mean, it's like we have the death roll of 10 women, which is huge. That's very shocking. But also because the way it was dealt with, as with some kind of not seriously dealt with at a public sphere level. If you look at the national Moroccan television, the way that no really formal statement was made about it. And the other important thing is that this hospital in Agadir was long replaced by a very new, modern, highly sophisticated hospital that was there, built, everything is there, but was not opened yet. So it is the death of the women, but also the kind of asking for governance and accountability. Why do we still run old and run down hospital where we have spent millions of Moroccan dirham building a new one? So that was that kind of questioning. And some of the protesters claimed that the prime minister himself did not want to go and open the new hospital for very political reason, because he was trying to move it as much as possible to make sure that it's close to election time. So that was also, so it's the deaths of the women, but also the asking for accountability. And the surprising part of it is that the doctors in a hospital, they generally have that kind of more, you know, reserve duty where they would not go too much to speak on the social media, but they did. I mean, a lot of meds and paramedics and medical personnel, they really started recording themselves and speaking about the bad condition. So the momentum was that it's from the young generation protesting, it's from the doctors themselves complaining about the work condition, and it's about the claim that why there is this delay in opening a new one, and the kind of sure. Very, very small electoral calculus, if you want.
Thank you, Katia. Now, Danana, listening to this economic context, discontent due to governance accountability issues, does that ring a bell when you think about back in 2022, Aragalaya, or is it did you have a different composition of the factors that motivated the people?
No, it is. I'm not sure whether it was Gen Z, to be very honest. Because I think the easy way to connect all the dots, even that's a conversation that is happening in Sri Lanka as we speak, easy way to connect all the dots is a conspiracy theory, because it's similar kind of protest events, maybe fired with Gen Z because you really cannot see the connection. But of course, I have a different view, mainly because of the economic factors. But of course, I must to an extent admit that there may be an algorithm impact that you feel the misery to a greater extent. But in the economic context, it is definitely in our case, it's very clear cut. I will give you a few statistics. There was this, everything like basically erupted in like 2022 during that period, like May, June, July, that period. But coming to that, we need to understand the new president came into power, that was President Gotabaya Rajapaksa, in 2019, November, and like the beginning of COVID. So there actually, he was very popular. In fact, he was popular to an extent which has never happened in Sri Lanka, where people painted the walls, because generally it was people put posters and it was quite ugly in terms of a city cleaning lens. So people said, no, we want a cleaner city, because he also had a reputation. If you have visited Colombo, a lot of public parks, it was done by him as the secretary to the Ministry of Defense. So people had that sentiment, okay, he wants a cleaner city. He was a retired army official, so things are neater, tighter, cleaner. So people drew, like they painted the walls with the objective of cleaning the city. So it was that, and on a volunteer basis, no paid, people bought paint on their own. So he was that popular. Of course, COVID happened. He was still popular. He brought people, Sri Lankan citizens from China. He got a separate aircraft. He was still popular. And then the economic conditions quite went on a different direction. Inflation was slowly catching up to about 70%. There was this theory called modern monetary theory brought up by his advisors and said, like, you can print any amount of money without causing inflation. And at the same time, they brought a policy saying that they want to move to the organic fertilizer movement, because there was supporters of the government who believed that chemical fertilizer causing kidney dysfunctionality. So they banned the chemical fertilizer importation pretty much at a very shorter period, even overnight. So as a result, the farmers, the agriculture sector was collapsing. Farmers could not get the expected harvest. And then there was this issue of cooking gas, where the gas cylinders were leaking. And again, the gas cylinders, the gas supply, which was in cylinders, I'm not sure in Europe, I think it comes in a pipe, but in our parts of the world, it comes in a cylinder. So there was a, and it's a state monopoly. There was another small player, but mainly the main company was a state-owned company. So there's this gas combination that comes in a gas cylinder. I really cannot recall. I think propane. And I think they have changed that composition. So as a result, from that nozzle, the gas was leaking and there was some gas cylinder pretty much of blast in households and people have died. So I think all these, and there was a narrative which I don't think can be based backed by facts, but because of the corruption issue, because they changed the composition of the gas to make more money, because I think propylene is cheaper, if I remember right, that particular one type of gas is cheaper. So they increased that percentage to get a bigger cut sort of a thing. So all that combined together, and then when you have 70% inflation, of course, you really did not have any forex to run your power plants. And then you had fuel shortages. So then there were long lines for fuel. There were no electricity for 12 hours. And still people were not like protesting. Because I remember it like yesterday. I had a chat. People were asked, I mean, some people said like, look, we are in like sort of a miserable situation. But still people were not on streets. People were still, they had higher degree of patience. And even questioning like, how come like people having like 8 hours and the power cuts were extending every other week, 5 hours, 6 hours, 10 hours. And then it went like completely uncontrollable. Then people came as a protest and it was first organized as just a protest which comes to Colombo and dispersed. But when people came to Colombo, they thought, no, we will stay here at the Gulf Face Green. Probably most of you, if you have visited Colombo, you have seen next to the Gulf Face Beach, there are all these big hotels, Shangri-Las, and everything is located. And then I think it was more a trigger point, but it was purely bad economic policy. But the narration was it more driven with corruption, which I have a slightly a different view. I would say it's mismanagement. It's mainly misallocation of resources done with mismanagement. And this allocation of resources is what caused to that greater sort of crisis mode to accelerate it. And when you have 70% inflation, when you have no fuel, no gas, no electricity, even your mobile phones were not working because it's connecting through a tower which runs on a battery power which has about 6 to 8 hour battery capacity. So after about 6-8 hours of power cut, your phone really doesn't get connected because your signal drops. So in that context, it's, I mean, a crisis and people coming to streets and protesting is unavoidable. So I would say rather you can claim it. It's a conspiracy theory. It's this, that, but it's completely the economic context that basically erupted the issue. But I agree to an extent, I think the tolerance levels were also very high, up to an extent. But afterwards, people could not really bear it. And of course, few trigger events, of course, erupted. And that's, I think, the nature of a crisis. Like you control it and there'll be one person dead at a fuel line and there's something happened. And, you know, that trigger event can completely explode the entire context, and then I think that's what happened after.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dana.
This is so fascinating because I think to a large extent what we saw in Nepal and in Indonesia also had similar sparks. But at the heart of it, for me, is the question of accountability. So yes, you might call it mismanagement of resources. Like Katya mentioned, we have a brand new hospital there. Why aren't we using that? Versus like relying on these old things. Even in Nepal, it's very similar. I think people are asking, where is our tax money gone? You know, why do thousands of Nepalese have to leave Nepal every day to find jobs elsewhere and very, you know, harsh working conditions in the Middle East or in Malaysia and, you know, are sending all these remittances back that the government is collecting taxes on, but where's the taxes gone? And so that was a major question for the protest in Nepal. I'm just wondering, because if you look at it from an accountability lens, it's very much a liberal movement for me across the globe in that sense, right? You're demanding accountability in a democratic framework. But at the same time, I'm also wondering, is it really liberal? Because we're all past that initial, the demands of the movement and so on and so forth. And we've all had sort of time to settle down in terms of like, okay, how are things moving forward, right? So if you look at the essence of the movement, do you really think that these protests really embody liberal values, or is it more coming from a socialist paradigm of like, you know, everything must be equal for everybody in terms of outcomes? What's your impression of how these movements have actually progressed? And Katia, if we could start off with you again.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I will answer in a case of Morocco. So there is a huge paradigm shift. If you look at the protest movements that just followed the start of the Arab Spring, that was in 2011, the protesters back then were having really political demands. So they were clearly framing them in terms of accountability and good governance. And also they were complaining about the alliance between business and politics and how they were demanding that you cannot just have the biggest businessman running the country because there is a conflict of interest. So their demand were clearly articulated across and around political line. When you look at the Gen Z protest movement 14 years later, you don't find the political demand. The way they express themselves is true. Even the demand for accountability is more subtle. So it's more a demand for access to free education, it's access to healthcare system. So I'm not sure that there is a kind of political orientation to start with, rather than a kind of being fed up with a whole political elite. So if you ask them, and there was a try by kind of a public intellectuals in Morocco to start a discussion with the Gen Z and to say, okay, I mean, we hear you, we understand that. Do you feel that it's the right time for you to start your own political party? To which they reply, nope, we don't want to do that. And it tells you something, it's revealing that their mistrust in the political system as a whole and the political parties that they feel and they consider as being corrupted, as a represented the old elite and what have you, made them completely disconnect from politics altogether. So to answer you, I really don't know, because their demands are not at all articulated across the political line. The way, if you want to go artificially and to look at their demand and to see, it's a mix of everything. At the same time, they want for more economic opportunities, more economic rights, which you will consider as some kind of more liberal in its sense, but also in terms of free education and re-questioning the investment. So it is, they really force us to even change our own paradigm and how we look at the protest movement, and sometimes to also accept that they can be protest movements that are completely not political. They don't want to express themselves around the political line. They don't want to even see themselves within which ideology they would really be, more to the left or more to the right, because for them, all of those are corrupted and they don't relate to them anymore.
That's very fascinating, Katia, because I think in Nepal, one thing that makes it sort of unique is there are political demands, but it's more about the system of governance. So it's more a demand for accountability, because people think, if I can vote for my president, so an executive that is directly elected somehow will make them more accountability. So it's not along ideological lines, but more a systematic reform in that sense. So it's very fascinating in that. Dana, in Sri Lanka...
Abhida, if you allow me, before you go to Dana, I just want to add the Indonesian experience just briefly, because it was triggered when the parliamentarians raised their housing allowances. above a level that would basically pay a household in a poor household in Indonesia for a whole year. So this gross unfairness and injustice that they get so much for their housing, where other people just don't know how to pay for a very small flat, that triggered it. So accountability, but also a deep sense of injustice, I think, was also in Indonesia the case. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that I think that's a very valid point. So in Sri Lanka, Dhana, you're making the point, it's very much about the economy, how the economy was doing. It was really badly mismanaged. You know, you've had the longest time amongst us to be on the protest movement. How do you think, retrospectively, if you look back at it, do you think there's a political flavor to the movement? How do you see that, were the demands really addressed? How do you think Sri Lanka's doing in that sense in terms of response to this protest?
In Sri Lanka's one, interestingly, when the protest movement started, there was one key element the protesters brought into the protest. They said it's non-violent. They were extremely peaceful till this one incident took place where everyone was at the Goldfish Green and Prime Minister's residence called Temple Trees was not too far from that. It's just walking distance. And they have called upon a meeting, and at the end of the meeting, there were thugs coming and like basically thrashing out the peaceful protesters. That was the trigger point. That's where people over all of a sudden went completely violent. And at the same time, the protests were named as like completely nonpartisan. There was no politician was allowed to even to come to the protest site, except one exception. Like there was the one army commander who contested against President Rajapaksa. He was only allowed to come. But others, even, for example, leader of the opposition, they were basically chased out in a way violently, saying that no politicians were ever allowed. So it was mainly flagged under apolitical because the rhetoric was all politicians are corrupt. So we need sort of a non-corrupt, more accountable governance system. It's interesting whether it's on the liberal point of view. I think accountability-wise, yes. And even on Rainer's point, I think what, you know, the availability of information that a minister would consume a housing allowance, which would be more than like per month, which is more than the entire housing allowance for a poor household for a year, that availability of that information on social media, I felt aggravated. Same in Sri Lanka. There were a lot of information, how things were basically mismanaged, how corruption took place, everything. And even people who were supported, the artists, the athletes, everyone who supported the previous regimes, they like put apology notes saying that, okay, we are very sorry and we think the misery of this country because of corruption. So it was very easy to narrate corruption. I agree with Arpita, it is accountability on a liberal sense, but I think it's the easy connection. Okay, where's our tax money going? Because that's what is visible. Someone has contributed, where it is going. But even at a deeper level, like if you even going back to the real reasons for a crisis, I think still the non-functionalities of that market system and all that is there. Because on a liberal sense, I would not endorse damaging a public property, because on our case, what was more popular came out, news stories was people are using the president's swimming pool. I can remember it was quite same in Afghanistan when the US troops were taken off, like people used like the gyms and all that, and circulating of videos. So I think it's the transformation of people, like, okay, you are using our tax money and now we are like taken the power to our hand, probably without the understanding of how the institutional framework works in a way. So I do not endorse that part, but definitely on the accountability side, there is a liberal lens. And in our case, as I mentioned, this non-violence and non-partisan was brought in. But having said that, also at the same time, the socialist movements were also trying to dominate the same narrative. They said, look, we are all equal. Our tax money has been taken. We all should have treated better. And they even said, like, because in our case, they created like a village in that Goldfish Green. So there were tents and tents. and there were washrooms basically created. There was some solar thing doing like, you know, generating power. There were people coming and donating like free food. So people who were like camping there for like months, food and water and essentials were being supplied. So they were saying, look, this is like a socialist world. You really need not to, you know, there's no leader here. Everyone is equal and we are getting food. We are getting health and there's, you know, but it's a very temporary thing. It doesn't really serve. I mean, you can do it as long as you're in a protest site. But when you're in the real life, like when you consider about your children's education and all that, there are libraries done, but it is not the real functionality of a society. So they were trying to portray it as like, this is the socialist world. And even their demand was, we all the protesters are agreeing to sort of a common about 10 commandments, or I really cannot recall the number. These are the 10 things that you have to agree, and then you have to sign off for it, and then we'll go for election, and there'll be some representation from the protest. And then there were left-leaning political actors who are slowly coming into play, but not on any mainstream media, mainstream political parties. So I agree, it's people's I would say, anger in one side. But in my case, still, I would heavily weight it on the economic. I mean, it's a trigger factor event. Like when you're vulnerable, it's just that one trigger completely explodes. But your vulnerability coming from that you're not dealing with the market system and an institutional system. And then when you're vulnerable, that one trigger event can completely collapse you. In our case, we have been vulnerable for a long time. And COVID happened, and on an economic scale, that COVID happened, that everything happened. So it was quite bad. And at the same time, on a protest scale, people were polite, and they were very patiently waiting. But that one trigger completely could take things into an uncontrollable level.
Thank you. Let me stay on this topic for a little while longer. And I would like to offer one perspective, and I'm curious what you think about it. So we've listened and we've heard quite a few causes and triggers that have caused these movements. But interestingly, so far at least, we see these movements largely in the what we call global south, in emerging economies. And I'm wondering whether we could also look at it in terms of that people become taxpayers. So the demand for accountability rises the more you are invested with your own money. And we've seen this in China, how protest movements increased when people had become taxpayers and they were really demanding to know, where's my money going? And so I'm wondering, is this a larger trend that we're seeing that we have in Morocco, Sri Lanka, and many other countries, that people actually say, wait a second, we are paying the government, they're building a hospital or whatever else. They are supposed to do something for my benefit with my taxpayers' money. Do you see this kind of a change in your societies that could also cause such anger?
I think in Morocco, the reflection would be that my father and mother are paying a lot of taxes, so I am entitled to some kind of good health services and education, rather than I am paying taxes because the unemployment rate within the younger generation and the Gen Z is so high, and the level of informal activities and economics where they don't pay taxes anyway is also so high. But there is this understanding that the older generation, that they pay taxes, but they did not really connect to the dots that paying taxes means accountability. So for them, it's just, I'm paying taxes because I have to pay them anyway. But I would say that the Gen Z, they are more aware and they can make this connection. So my parents are paying and I'm entitled to good healthcare and to education as well.
Thank you. And Dana, what do you think?
Yeah, so that's an interesting observation, which I haven't thought about. But when this happened, majority of our population were not taxpayers. But probably, not taxpayers in the sense direct taxpayers, but of course, everyone contributes through indirect channels. So, but I think that, yes, I agree to an extent that, you know, the feeling that I have paid my taxes on as VAT and as on consumption, and now you have wasted, that is there. But I think it also can be easily, that emotion can be easily targeted and it appears, okay, you know, something that you could have done on something else, now someone has taken it and like they have built, you know, some empire on it, was the narrative. And I think that work to bring people together or like to a protest. But it is because at the one reason, if you recall, one reason Sri Lanka went through it is because our tax revenue was one of the lowest in the world as a percentage of GDP. But of course, people don't see it in that sense. People see it, it's like still it must have been corrupt. But also it's a corruption. Yeah. As an overall addition, it's not sometimes the politicians corrupt because of their henchmen, like the extra cost that I have to pay to my, you know, for my living standard, to maintain my living standard sort of a thing. So it's an easy emotion to basically, I would say, trigger people.
Exactly, because it's not necessarily just taxes. It could be informal payments that you have to pay on the street to whoever demands, right?
This
can have all different sorts.
I think there's an interesting dimension that you bring in, Rainer, because in Nepal's case, I really do think it is the realization of taxes to a certain extent, because the government had imposed taxes on revenue that you receive through content creation. So, you know, and this specifically hits a younger generation who were making their earnings via TikTok or running these small businesses, selling items using TikTok or, you know, so on and so forth. So I do think there is a certain, because you get your ad revenue and it comes from a foreign account. And the government had recently introduced, like, I think it's a flat rate of 5% tax on any kind of foreign, you know, either consulting or you call it revenue that you earn from foreign sources. And so there's a flat 5% tax rate. It's not a big tax rate, but at the same time, I think it hits hardest on a lot of young people who are part of this movement. But I mean, the bigger trigger for us was just a social media ban as well, because the government tried to cut off the one channel that, you know, everybody was reliant on. But it's an interesting perspective overall.
And we're just trying to collect all the different causes and triggers, and there are probably more, but it would be interesting to always to see and prioritize what happened and what caused it. But now let's look a little bit more at the actual way it all happened. So we see especially Morocco, Nepal, Indonesia, Sri Lanka. We need to listen to Tana, whether he confirms this or not, but utterly leaderless. There are groups that connect with each other on whatever platform that's available. Katia mentioned already Discord, which is quite popular in many countries among the Gen Z. And they coordinate in a very loose way, and then the protests erupt. That means they're not really using traditional political structures. It does not go through a party that helps them voice their protests. It does not go through your usual, let's say, NGOs, or movements or pre-existing structures. This is something spontaneous that comes about. Now, in a way, it's refreshing to have it that way. On the other hand, it also undermines certain institutions that are still nascent. So if you have a young democracy, for example, you may have new political parties, and this might sort of also have a damage for the building of political parties. It can have a damaging effect on voicing your opinions through elections and then through parliament. So I'm just wondering how do you see this unfolding, and Katia? But then for Dana, it also leads to that question. You already said it's not necessarily a Gen Z movement that happened in Sri Lanka. So maybe it came about in a slightly different way. But let's start with Katia on this one. How did it all happen, and what are the consequences for the institutions in the country? What do you think?
You would generally think that it is leaderless and that it all started through different social media networks, and it was based on a city. So there were the Discord group for the city of Casablanca, for example, the one for the city of Tangier, because the discussions started a couple of weeks before the real physical in-person protest movement in the major cities. But then again, there are voices also that see that it is not that leaderless, in a sense that you will all the time find within a specific Discord group a leader, a conversation leader, someone who is throwing ideas over there and all the others reacting more to the idea that has been suggested by the leader themselves. So it is leaderless in the classical sense that we know of, but still there is some form of leadership within the group itself. In a case of Morocco, some interesting observation is that we have what you would call in Europe a democratic fatigue before getting to being a full-fledged democracy. It's a very interesting paradox, because it is not that Morocco has been a full-fledged democracy for, you know, decades, and now people have a fatigue. They don't want to go to the election process because they see it does not make much changes in their daily life, or that the major decisions are taken in Brussels, or, you know, the kind of context that you would have in Europe. In Morocco, there is the fatigue of asking. I mean, we hold regular election. There are multiple political parties, from the Islamists to the more radical left socialists to more of the center left and the right and what have you. There is a political expression through political parties, and Morocco hold regular elections, and they happen to be, you know, partially free, and there are observers from different political party and international organizations. So if you want, the democratic process is there. It's not full-fledged. We still have our own challenges. But what's happened with my generation, for example, is that we have seen this change. You know, we have seen a change from a prime minister that was appointed directly by a king to going to a more of a constitutional transition where the prime minister comes directly from the election process itself. But with the new generation, they are not. They don't make sense of that change. For them, it's so subtle, it's so insignificant, that it is not that important. So they have this fatigue that they would not go into any kind of conventional politics because they perceive it as being corrupt. They perceive political parties as being corrupt. They see them as so well entrenched with diverse economic interests, and they don't want to be part of the youths of those political parties, because they also happen to have their young movement within political parties. But at the same time, they don't want to start another political party because they feel that if they do, they would be, their movement would be hijacked, and they would become part of a much bigger corrupted system itself. So it is somehow complicated, because even when the states or the different political parties want to open up a discussion, that's the first thing they would point out to, seeing that those movements are so leaderless. With whom are we going to talk? They don't want to engage in any kind of political, conventional way of doing politics. So they have these arguments that make them not willing really to engage with the Gen Zs. Again, one of the things that has been done in Morocco in, I would say, professional way, if you want, is that following the protest movement, it was less than a week that the public media started to invite people from the Gen Z movement to speak. So there was this kind of, we want this time to be open about it. We want to have different political parties come in to comment, to give them more expression, and to make sure that by giving them more expression in the more official and public channel, we are also somehow containing the movement itself. And I think that kind of tactics or strategy, if you want to call it, has been successful in mainstreaming the Gen Z protest movement.
That is so fascinating, because I think Nepal's case shows the total destruction of like all public properties and really creating a power vacuum. So I'm really looking at Tana in that sense of trying to, what's the example from Sri Lanka like in terms of like addressing the movement, A, and B, containing it? Because Katya's example is also a very interesting one.
Yeah, so coming back to Gen Z matter, why I said it was not, in my view, it was not mainly Gen Z, but if you go to the protest sites, it was not really the Gen Z who was there. It was fairly older, senior audience who were mainly running the protest sites. It was not the Gen Z. Of course, there was a heavy social media angle to it, but it wasn't. How we contained it was, of course, it's in a way questionable because it was then there was on that transition. Actually, I'm not sure what went under the table or what really happened. Because when the president left the country, of course, there have been books being written. There were so many stories. I really cannot understand what is true and what is not. So after president leaving, there's a constitutional process that need to take place. So then the prime minister takes over, and then the parliament has to appoint a president. And somehow that process remained. Because there was at one point a conversation that people should go and also capture the parliament, but that has been stopped by the military intervention to an extent. So there were calls to pretty much take over the parliament, but for I don't know how they managed it. My understanding is mainly the military intervened and said, look, this is it, like, you know, you cannot move from here, sort of a thing. But then the prime minister took over. Probably the chain of order may also have come from understanding the danger. If the parliament was also taken over, it could have been completely lawless. Things would have been severe. And then, of course, it's a general procedure that followed. And that's how a prime minister who basically was, I think, 5 or 6 times the prime minister, was lost a presidential election, came again back as the president through a parliamentary process. And then the elections were held after 2 years. Then it was pretty much the smooth democratic transition. So that's basically how it happened. And later on, the president who fled the country came back. Same privileges pretty much were given. Housing to security, as everything has been given. So then it became to normal. See, at the same time, then we entered to an IMF program. And then there was some economic backing. As a result, long lines disappeared. Electricity was kind of back. And there was no reason. At the same time, the then president, like, who came as the through the constitutional process, they also pretty much tried to clear through military forces the protest sites, which has been condemned globally. That was like the sequence of actions. I think people also in a way like hold it to a level, but afterwards you really run out of resources in a way, because everyone has to get back to their normal lives and everyone has aspirations, things like that. So that's how it happened. That's why I'm not very much on the side of it's a Gen Z thing. Definitely there's an influence. But when you look at people who are really in the upfront, people who fought and lost their lives, and I mean, it was not really the Gen Z. They were more on the phones. But it was really people who really came to the streets on this occasion.
That's very fascinating. And Raina, I wanted to bring you in this conversation because with Indonesia, it was sort of a flash movement that happened and somehow the international news lost interest. So what was happening? How was the protest like really addressed within the Indonesian system overall?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, Apita, because it kind of takes me also to my next question. But talking about Indonesia, in a way, it sounds a bit like what Katia said. So immediately people were basically disinterested, if you want, in a democratic process because they didn't feel they really benefit from it in the long run. And so the first buildings that burnt in Indonesia were state legislatures across the country. So the protests went directly against parliaments. Not the national parliament, that was also heavily protected, but it went against state legislatures, interestingly, which you might want to say they might be the first where they would maybe get their voices heard, but that's where they get angry with. So it's this lack of accountability, lack of, and then corruption that is quite widespread in Indonesia, and everybody knows about that. So that was, these thoughts were triggered when Katia also talked about how the Gen Z view democracy and what it means to them. And maybe they see it slightly more in the utilitarian and realistic way of what it does it do to me. And if I have high unemployment and maybe come out of the pandemic, maybe it doesn't do much to me. So it's not so much about institutions. It's just really about the chance to find a job at the end of the day, to make a living. And yeah, but that then leads to my question where, you know, you never know who plays which role in a protest. In Indonesia, it was immediately rife with speculations that students may have been the ones triggering it, but are there other forces joining this and instrumentalizing this? So that is a discussion I believe we have had in all countries where Gen Z movements were up on the streets. And then sometimes you have destabilizing and then you have stabilizing forces. When I am, if I am reading this correctly, Katia, you have the monarchy in Morocco, which holds the country stable and prevents major disruptions of life. Whereas in Indonesia, the speculation was quite strong that security forces were behind these riots because they happened so quickly and they also stopped so quickly that there was a lot of suspicion that these were not the students who did this, but these were other actors with a different agenda. And then you look at Madagascar, at least there is now a military leader after the Gen Z protests. Whether it's a better military leader or worse, that I don't know. But generally speaking, now we suddenly have a military leader in Madagascar in power. So my question that I want to formulate is, you know, what comes out of these protests? Has it, like as Dananath is saying, forced the head of government to escape, but then come back and basically, you know, get the same privileges as before? In Bangladesh, they passed the death penalty on the president who fled the country. In Madagascar, you have the military. In other countries, in Indonesia, a couple of parliamentarians were suspended because of their remarks that were not satisfying, but they're all back by now. So some go back to business as usual. What is your view on this? Do we see any influence that these movements really have, whether youth or not, so, Nana?
Yeah, so there were high expectations just after the Gen Z protest movement started. The King of Morocco was scheduled to give opening remark for the winter-autumn session of the parliament, and he, I mean, it's a traditional, conventional opening remark that he does. But given that it coincides with the Gen Z protest movement, everyone was glued to their TV to see if he would, because that's mostly conventional, traditional opening remark that generally does not spark that much attention. But that this time of the year was very special. Everyone was thinking that he would address the Gen Z protest movement, but he didn't, because that was also a very conventional speech in which he addressed the work of the member of the parliament, urging them to be more proactive, urging them to really do their job the right way. But that was pretty much it. But a couple of weeks later, there were a very direct changes that were made to the budget allocated to education and healthcare. So it was made clear by the government that the budget allocated to healthcare and to education would increase and was increased for this new 2026 new government budget. I mean, how they would finance that, it's another question. But that was the direct consequence, if you want, as a way to say that we hear you, we understand that. And also because Morocco is hosting the African Cup, Football Cup, starting in a couple of weeks. And of course, is preparing to start the World Cup for 2030. So there are a lot of investments made for the football stadium and for the accompanying infrastructure. One of the protest claim and demand of the Gen Z is that a lot of budget goes to football, and it may also make sense to have bigger part go into education and healthcare. And by making this shift and putting some more money into education and healthcare, it gives the impression that the government has been more flexible and willing to engage somehow with the demand of the Gen Z without engaging with them in a direct way. So it's a very indirect way of doing things. And if you want now, it has the movement fades away seriously. Like before, we had them all over the streets in different big cities. But now it's a very, very small, isolated protest movement. They continue the discussion on Discord. But then again, people get sometimes carried away with their life activities and what have you. And the movement is no longer as strong as it was at the end of September and the beginning of October.
Thank you. And Dana?
Yeah, so I think in our case, I think it's still too early to say whether after that protest, too early. This is like, there are definitely reforms that took place. For an example, the Central Bank Independence Act, where you cannot really do monetary financing or money printing, has been contained with the new Central Bank Act. And there's not a public debt management institutional framework that brought it. And even if you look at the parliament elections that followed up, I mean, about 2/3 or even more than that were completely voted out in the parliamentary system, and a new set of people being brought in voting. So there were changes actually took place. Whether again that new lot is better than the previous lot, that's where we need to have the time and check. Whether they will reverse some of these institutional reforms, that again, that we have to check. But I can say one thing, that crisis and the role of think tanks and the ideas of liberty is very important. And that, in a way, in our case, shaped the way and the reforms that took place. Because on the impulse of your property rights, securing the sound money concept, that at least you have to, you know, secure the value of your money. And that's what lead to those reforms and the public debt management. All those reforms mainly came as a result of this crisis. And we are glad that we were part of the contribution on that narration of like having the research work. On the initial question on state-owned enterprises, the work that we have been doing, there was a committee appointed to restructure. And still even a kind of, you know, the left of the center, or the left-leaning government even considering to consolidate and close down some of those state enterprises shows the impact that it had on the public thinking on why these reforms are. And that's where I think the role of us probably has been there, because it was not like an overnight thing, because that research on state-owned enterprises was there for about 6 to 8 years when this thing happened and that information was available. So it's important that we have that background homework ready when the society is ready for this sort of a transformation to get that going. My worry is that it wasn't enough for us to really have the growth and to really see the changes that we would like to see. But at least what was done was not possible without even that limited work that we have done. So that's where I think it comes into play. In our case, that's again, to reiterate the since this podcast being generally listened by people who are engaged in this space, because in our case, we said that, look, a debt crisis is coming. And of course, we also even said with the debt crisis, things will be difficult. It comes with like, another about 4 to 5 crises, including a political crisis, humanitarian crisis, so on and so forth. Only crisis that we rescued ourselves was a banking crisis. It wasn't the Greece. People were not in the line at the ATM, but pretty much on everything else. But that's the importance of the work that we do. I want to reiterate, because we cannot imagine how worse things could have been without pretty much at least the little contribution that we have done. And for that, we are glad, but also we are sad that things could have been much better if they listened a little bit more on the thinkers like us thought and said before the crisis came into play.
All right. I think that's a very positive note, actually, Dana, for you to show us some role for civil society organizations to come forward and, you know, work in this vacuum. In Nepal, we have a say, well, we have a running joke that every 10 years we're ready for another revolution. So let's hope this one lasts for another 10 years. But it was a really fascinating discussion. I think we're still seeing ripple effects. And one of the things that is very clear is, because we are so globally connected, or the coming generation is so globally connected, this is just going to ripple around the world. Mexico is the latest. We're going to see more countries coming up. And it's really fascinating how different systems react to it differently, where somewhere it has caused, like, you know, semi-positive outcomes. I would look at Sri Lankan case. Bangladesh is very much on the fence still, you know, but in some places it's, you know, back to square one. Nothing has changed much. So yeah, let's hope, at least for my country, we're praying, since we are still heading towards elections, that some positive change comes over. But thank you very much for your time today, discussing a very complex issue in general that we are, I think, still trying to grapple with and understand in general. And I hope this conversation really contributed to that a little bit. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, that was a very interesting conversation, Apita, wasn't it? I mean, this is something that is going around the globe. As you said, the latest one that we've seen now is Mexico, but it has been in Asia, it has been in Africa, now it's in Latin America. So many perspectives. Might be a little too early, what do you think, to actually do the final assessment of this?
Everyone wonders
whether it's possible to have a final analysis, because it's still country specific, even though it's a global kind of thing, isn't it?
That's very true. I think most of the analysis that I've seen out there of these movements is, sure, some people are saying this is like a social contagion. Yes, you can call it that. We live in an interconnected world and therefore more likely to have spreading. But to me, that is the mechanism. I think what it points to is, people are deeply dissatisfied with how governance systems so far have been designed. They're not necessarily meeting the demands of people who are demanding a lot more voice and accountability. And I don't think the systems we have designed so far are necessarily equipped to bring all these voices together. So that is what I see so far. But I don't know, what do you think?
Yeah, it's that discontent, right? And you have this being voiced in different ways and at different occasions. So you may have a spark like these poor women dying in Morocco, or in Indonesia, it was a delivery driver was run over by a police car. So you have these very unfortunate triggers, but they come at a time when the people are frustrated. And the frustration we also have in other places. I was saying during the recording that what we see, the Gen Z movements are largely in the global south, but we have the discontent also in the global north. We have that in Europe. We have that in the United States. We can see it quite clearly. It's just expressed in different ways so far. But the question is always, we see the noise and we see the frustration. How does the government, how do people in power respond? Do they hear it? And if they do, do they know how to respond? Do they just appease? Do they restructure? What's actually happening is highly complex.
I agree. And I think that is the critical question in general. It's how people in power respond. Are you really listening to what people are saying? And this is across the globe. Like you said, the movement is just different in different forms. In the global north, it has just been expressed very differently for me. You know, if you look at Europe and to a certain extent the United States, if you look at the rise of what is termed as the far right movements, in general also comes from a lot of place of discontent in the existing system. And that's a different form. Where probably it's more politically motivated in that sense. With the Gen Z, it's what we've seen is largely very apolitical But regarding that system, again, trying to be a part of that political process, whether you form a political party or not, but trying to have your voices heard, right? And so that is a very fascinating way. But I think it's too soon to say where this is going to lead us.
But it requires answers very soon. I mean, it's too early to make the analysis. But when we hear Katia talking about democracy fatigue, that's a worrying sign in countries that do have developed a democracy and see it also being undermined at the moment by various forces.
Absolutely.
And if the youth loses interest in participation in the political arena, then we're in trouble.
Well, on that very, very happy note of Rainer warning us about how much trouble we're in, thank you very much for joining us on this episode of Continued Conversation. We wish it was more satisfying in terms of being able to grant answers. But I think I would revert back to what Tana said right at the end, is there is always a space for civil society organizations and groups like ours, or even if you're an activist, for your voices to be heard in whenever there are new civil spaces that are opening up. And that's exactly when you hit with good reform ideas. And for that, you need to be prepared. I think that's a very positive note to end on.
It is, absolutely. Fully agree. Thank you very much.